Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mondo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mondo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mondo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mondo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mondo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
That's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here!
Hey, Joe, how are you?
And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, but first, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
All right, I want to welcome all of my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. That's whiterosesociety.org. My good friend Ben Birch hosting my archives there. And, of course, all my fans at rantsradio.com listening in on Thursdays and Sundays. And we have a very special show tonight because I have with me not one, not two, but three guests this evening. One over the phone and two right here with me in the studio. My first guest is a former attorney for the State Department who left his job to work for Governor Howard Dean's campaign as Dean for America's Director for House Party Fundraising. Now, house parties are a combination of old-style grassroots politics with new technologies like telephone conferencing. Under Mr. Saley's leadership, Governor Dean's house party program engaged over 80,000 participants, taught over 3,500 supporters how to become grassroots leaders, and raised over $2 million for Governor Dean's presidential campaign. Would that he could do the same for me. Mr. Saley now works with clients, including the John Kerry campaign, to improve their grassroots outreach and fundraising techniques, teaching them to balance the use of cost-effective technology with old-style meetings. So you can check out his website at www.party2win.com. That's party, the number two, win.com. So without further ado, let me switch over to the telephone so I can...
Welcome to the show for the second time. David Saley, how are you?
Good. How are you, Joe?
Fine. I say this for the second time because we actually tried to do this, what was it, on Monday or Tuesday?
I think it was Tuesday morning.
Tuesday, and we've been having occasional power blackouts here at the Enterprise Studios because of the Hurricane Francis wreaking havoc all through the Southeast. Now, as I read in the bio, Mr. Saley was in charge of house party fundraising for the Dean campaign, and he's now doing the same for the Kerry campaign. Is this correct?
I've assisted the Kerry campaign for a little bit. I helped them get the program off the ground. In fact, the Kerry campaign is not doing fundraising anymore, as you might recall, since John Kerry opted into federal election funds. So it's the DNC that's raising money, and I also assisted them for the first part of their house party program. But generally, I'm helping clients, small and large throughout the United States, American politics, to help them get their house party program and organizing party programs off the ground.
Okay, well, let's talk about how you got started in this. Now, what you got started working in when what campaign? When did you start being active in politics?
Being a Washingtonian, living in Washington, D.C., my spouse and I have always kind of marginally been involved in politics and did a little bit of political fundraising, I guess, really during the Gore Lieberman campaign, we started doing a little bit more. Did a couple, you know, fundraisers, went to fundraisers. In fact, before I became a federal government employee, right after law school, I was doing some more kind of get out the vote type things and fundraising. My spouse actually spent a week in Oregon to help do some get out the vote and electioneering things. But it really wasn't until I met Governor Howard Dean about 6 months before the 2002 elections, in the spring of 2002, where I was really motivated to begin working essentially full time and essentially for free in order to change America and get the Republicans out of the White House.
Governor Dean was really good at inspiring people to do that, wasn't he?
Oh my goodness, yes. I have story after story of fellow volunteers. I actually was a volunteer for the first 5 months of the campaign and then became a staff member. So fellow volunteers during the early portions and other staffers and volunteers who had never been so active in politics. And that's one of the things that I'm most proud of, probably the thing that I'm most proud of being part of that campaign, because there remain so many people who are now who have become activists because of the message that Governor Dean and his campaign and his people brought to American politics. It really has inspired a lot more activism.
Well, what I like to do is remind my listeners of a sense of history, and progressive movements always take time, but there always seems to be a focal point. And Governor Dean, just with myself, although I had been kind of involved in politics or at least knowledgeable about politics, I just liked his very straightforward, you know, here's a problem, let's see how we fix it, never mind the ideology style.
Yeah, I think you're right, Joe. I think Governor Dean's voice came in at the time when it needed to, and when the Democratic Party wasn't responding to something that a lot of Americans, a lot of good progressive Democrats, and independents for that matter, wanted to hear. It was at a time early in the campaign when he was putting it together. He didn't plan on being the anti-war candidate, but this was a time when a lot of Americans felt uncomfortable with the direction that the United States was going, both in, you know, could have been with regard to tax cuts, with regard to a march toward war, with regard to how we were handling the war on terrorism and working with or not working with our international allies. And they weren't finding a voice for those concerns until Governor Dean appeared. I think he owes a lot of, I think we owe a lot of that to his political courage, really, in kind of coming out there and saying the things he did consistently, straightforwardly, when nobody else would.
Now, when you started out as a volunteer, did you do some of the usual things other people do and volunteer? Did you stuff envelopes? Did you go pound the pavement door to door, stuff like that?
Well, there weren't even any envelopes to stuff when I volunteered. I actually, after meeting Governor Dean in the spring, kind of sent feelers out among some of my friends and contacts who were working as advisors to Governor Dean, and literally it was two or three people at that time. He was still the governor of Vermont, and he didn't really have a campaign staff. He was still exploring. But in October of 2002, I was invited by him. I told him and his people that if he was willing to take me on, I would work for him for free for 6 months. And then we would see where it would go. I mean, even back then, there was very little thought that this was going to go very far. But I just knew that this was something that I needed to do because I really respected Governor Dean for what he was doing. And so I literally was one of maybe two or three other people who were working in anywhere across the United States for him. So when I spoke with him, he said, "Great, that's great. I'd love you to work for me. Help me raise money. We want to qualify for Federal Election Commission matching funds as soon as possible. In order to do so, we need to raise $5,000 in matchable donations in 20 different states or jurisdictions across the United States. So, you know, hop to it." And so beginning in November, after I quit my job as an attorney advisor for the U.S. Department of State, I was a lawyer for the U.S. government doing Iraq policy, quit my job and started trying to figure out how to build a house party fundraising program. And I was working out of my home. I continued to work out of my home for months and months thereafter. Had my email, had my email account, had my internet up and running, and had my telephone, and just sat on the phone. So I didn't do too much pavement pounding. A little bit. It turns out that my area of Washington D.C. became one of the most vocal and earliest adopters of the Howard Dean for America message. So I did do a little, you know, talking among my friends and neighbors, but because my my jurisdiction was nationwide, I spent just a ton of time exploring my own personal contacts, the growing list of supporters that had registered their interest in the Dean for America campaign, and just talked with them and learned how to teach them to be amateur fundraisers for a political campaign, and taught them how to teach others, and that's how it started.
Oh, that's very cool. Now, did you start using using the internet as a tool in a big way, or did Joe Trippi show you anything, or did you show Joe Trippi some things?
I think all of us on the Dean campaign figured out how to use the internet in different ways. My initial approach was telephone and email lists. And I tell you, a big breakthrough occurred when, this was even before Joe Trippi joined the campaign, but I had gone on one of, I would travel up to Burlington every 2 or 3 months to reintroduce myself to the growing staff. The first couple times I would go there and they'd be like, who is this guy? And there were only 3 or 4 people in the office at that point anyway. By the spring, there were more and more people, and I kept having to remind them that, well, I actually you know, work for the campaign, and I'm based in Washington, D.C. out of my home, and I run the House Party program. But on one of my trips, like in February of 2003, I heard people talking about these Yahoo groups, discussion groups, and listservs. I was like, that's something that I should explore. And I found it, and to this day, I continue to find it a wealth of information and a wonderful forum in which people spontaneously gather together. These are generally not things that are put together by organizations or by campaigns. These are people who find them, who have their own interest areas, find themselves kind of and spread the word and just kind of discuss things. Similarly, the meetup phenomenon was also something that was introduced to me in January of 2003. I was at one of a physical fundraiser, an event that Governor Dean actually attended in Washington, D.C. At that point, it turned out to be the largest fundraiser that we had done at that point in the campaign. I think it was over $20,000 raised, which was a pretty penny in January of 2003. And someone said, oh, yeah, I heard of Governor Dean at the meetup. And I'm like, the meetup? What is the meetup? And, of course, you know, since then the story is a lot of people know what meetups are. But it was in January when there were probably, I think the nationwide count of meetups was in the 300 or 400 participants nationwide. Of course, it quickly grew to 120, 140, well, quickly, over the course of the campaign, grew to about 120 or 130,000 people. But to this day, I still think that the way the internet facilitates discussion with things like MSN groups and Yahoo groups and other kind of online forums that offer free participation are just wonderful ways to learn about the discussions that are going on out there, learn about the ways that people are engaging in the political process, as well as the meetup.
Now, you see, if I had the time to really go in, because I'm a member of several groups, and I feel it's kind of unseemly to advertise my show too much on these groups because they're really not for the Cup of Joe show.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, if I wanted to advertise, you know, the show, that would be a way of doing it and getting the name out there, although I'd probably get some people annoyed doing it too much. But
right. I'm also waiting for other, I'm sure with the success of Yahoo and with the success of meetups, I'm waiting for other groups to kind of come up with additional, different formats for people to explore. I haven't found too many of them yet. There are a couple good forums out there as well.
Well, we Democrats seem to have really latched onto that a lot more than the Republicans have. I mean, the Republicans have their own thing, but it doesn't seem to be anywhere near as organized as we have it on our side.
You know, my theory about that is that the fundamental way that these kind of organizations work, where it's kind of bottom-up, people forming it themselves and kind of creating order out of chaos, fundamentally works better with the way Democrats, or at least people on the left, kind of the independent liberal streak of people on the left, fundamentally works better with the way we kind of want to be organized. I think traditionally people consider the Republican and the right side of politics, the supporters, are far more interested in following orders, you know, taking the talking points, repeating the talking points, and just saying, you know, I'm ready, let me do what you know you've decided I need to do. It wasn't until the internet and these kinds of forums that really kind of helped to impose order on the chaos out there among different groups with quite disparate ideas. Democrats and liberals are well known for having having internecine arguments because we all have such a diversity of views. And the nice thing about these kinds of things and the way that the Dean campaign really corralled those people and gave them direction and gave them a sense of being able to work together, I think it works fundamentally. And I think the house party system, which is what I continue to do right now, is another way that it actually plugs into the skills and the talents of our supporters in the progressive community. It's not we are going to have, you know, 7 house parties in Atlanta and 12 house parties in New York City, and you're going to do this at 7 o'clock and this at 7:30 and this at 8. It is we have an opportunity out there for any group to join. If you'd like to plug into a conference call with our candidate or with this, you know, executive director of a progressive group, or if you'd like to, you know, talk about this or talk about that, then you're more than welcome to do so. Please, you know, come here and we'll help you if you can. But for the most part, it leaves 80 or 90% of the planning and of the initiative up to the people who organize it, which is, I think, a wonderful thing that really resonates with the progressive community.
And I think that's one of the reasons why I enjoyed the Dean campaign so much. As little as I participated, I did as much as I could, considering I have to work a 40-hour work week. I'm not like a rich lawyer like you. You know, I'm just this working guy, so I can't afford to take the time off of work. You know, but it is nice that. That people do seem to take their time to do this. It's like me doing the radio show. I don't get a penny from doing this radio show or the blog. And Atrios and Daily Coast, well, they get a little bit of money from donations now, but they didn't start out thinking, oh, we're going to make money off of this.
Well, I think we might need to do some house party fundraisers for your show.
Oh, sure. That would be wonderful. Yeah, I could use every penny I can get with all the stuff with my wife going on. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's say... Let's go into this for the sake of argument. Let's try to get more into the nuts and bolts of how this thing works. Mm-hmm. Let's say for the sake of argument that the Democratic National Committee or somebody said to you, okay, here's Joe Vecchio. He's going to be a candidate for Congress in Georgia. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I have no name recognition right now. They just pick my name out of a hat for whatever reason. And I need to get started from the ground up. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're like my fundraiser guy. How would you start out sending out a message for Joe Vecchio, candidate for Congress? And how would you start out getting parties organized for that?
Well, I think the way you start out for a house party program, even with this kind of technology available, even with partytowin.com or meetups, the way to start out a campaign really hasn't changed from the way campaigns began, you know, thousands of years ago or hundreds of years ago. You first have to reach out to the people who know you and the people who are on your own list. It's friends and family for starters. In fact, no matter how large or small my clients are, whether it was the Dean campaign or the DNC on the large side, or smaller groups like Gender Public Advocacy or the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, you will get 80% of your positive responses in terms of contribution, in terms of agreement to, yes, I'll go knock on doors for you, or I'll post a sign, or I'll write letters. You get 80% of your support from people who already know you. They already know your story. They already respect you. They already know where you're coming from. For any given initiative, you should reach out to new people, but you really have to base it on people who already know you. So, like with the Dean campaign, I relied heavily on, exclusively from the start, on people who I knew. They knew me. They knew my kind of political leanings. They respected me. And when I went to them and said, hey, there's this really great governor from Vermont who's running a rough-and-tumble campaign for president, believe it or not, we need to do what we can in order to keep his voice in the race, the first 12 house parties that I organized in January of 2002 were 2003, were those by people who I knew. I asked my social studies teacher from high school in Atlanta, Georgia. I asked my sister out in L.A. I asked my my mother-in-law up in upstate New York, friends of ours down in Miami, Florida, who are law school professors, friends of ours in San Francisco, the Bay Area, who are friends of mine from law school. Reach out to the people you know first. The House Party Program is a great way to expand that list of supporters and people who are familiar with you and know about you, because we find consistently, this is all the way through the Dean campaign, that if you assiduously collect the names of people who pass through your door, people who might be inclined to contribute or might be inclined just to listen, about 75 or 80% of the people who attend those events are newcomers. If you can capture their information, it's quite valuable for you as a candidate or for you as a cause, because you not only have quality information of these people, you know their name, where they live, how to contact them by email, You also know that they've had some sort of experience with you. If it was a house party that featured a conference call with Joe Vecchio and they spent 20 minutes in a Q&A session with you, that's invaluable for them, having kind of gotten a sense not only of who you are, but how you handle questions, how you handle crowds, how you come across on a phone or in person, and also being able to tell that story to people beyond. So that's really how it starts. The internet is great. I didn't even talk about the internet, you know, reach out into email lists and things like that, because really it's a combination of using technology, much of which is free or very inexpensive, using technology to continue to do politics the old-fashioned way. You can just do it at light speed when you can use email lists and when you can use conference call technology in order to tie first two, then a dozen, and then 200, and then 2,000 events together nationwide.
I think it caught some people off guard when the internet got used for that purpose, really for the first time on a big scale, because a lot of people had knew that the internet existed and a lot of people got on it, but I don't think they really recognized the scope of it the way the Dean campaign did earlier on, and it was really tremendous. The Republicans, the most of their support like that came from the churches when the religious right first started getting seriously involved. And part of that was because Jimmy Carter was going to start investigating the Robertsons and the Falwells and stuff like that, and they realized the gravy train might be over. And so they organized people, like you said, starting from the people they knew, people who went to church.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just kind of ballooned from there. But they didn't really need that internet as a tool, but we certainly did as well, because we didn't have a set area like that where our supporters go all the time, because we Democrats were all over the place. The Republicans always seem to march in lockstep.
Well, I think for the Democrats this election and going forward, it is a challenge for us to train our people. I think people on the right, or those in the religious right, are, as you said, trained to go once a week to a certain place to do a certain thing, in their case, worship. I mean, there are a lot of people who worship on the left as well, but many people are not. Many people on the left in the progressive community, I think, are not voting because they don't have that discipline. Some of the things that have occurred in this race have gotten people used to the idea of getting up and actually doing something periodically. The meetups that happen once a month really, I think, have served to train people who may never have voted, never have been in kind of an organized movement before, much like some people's religion, much like other people's community groups. They got the sense of, okay, you know, every once in a while, once a week or once a month, set aside time to do something. I'm hoping that training that people have been going through over the past year and a half or so in terms of meetups and in terms of more and more get-out-the-vote activities will result in a far larger percentage of the progressive community showing up at the polls on November 2nd and not being distracted by, oh, I got to go to work, or, oh, the lines are too long, you know. Get there, vote.
Well, I like the idea of what Howard Dean said, is that what Governor Dean was talking about, how it's more than just changing presidents. You have to change America. And in order to change America, people have to actively participate. And the house parties are certainly a wonderful way for people to just get to know each other on a face-to-face basis. You know, you can talk to an anonymous person over email for so long, but when you meet them in person, it's a lot of different thing. Back in my father's day, when the Democrats were really, really organized in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, you know, they met at their bowling alleys or they met at their local, you know, American Legion clubs, whatever, you know, and they all met face-to-face. I mean, there wasn't anything like the internet. The only way mass communication was out there was like the radio, and, of course, people did not have access to radio transmitters
right.
like that. So,
right.
David, it's been really nice having you on the show here.
We
hope you continued success with the Kerry campaign, and of course we all want Senator Kerry to win this election. Well, all of us are on the left anyway, and we're working really hard, and I appreciate your insight into how these things operate, because quite frankly it's all a mystery to me. Going by what you said about me starting off with the core group of people, the people who know me, if that's the case, then I'm already sunk as a candidate. Nobody in my family likes me that much. No, I'm kidding.
Well, I think the best thing we can do to help Kerry at this point is to ensure that he has as large coattails as possible, and making sure that if he gets elected, that a President Kerry, a Kerry administration, has a Congress that is Democrat, a Senate that's Democratic, and as many Democrats at the local and state level as possible.
That's right.
That's why we're working on a Turn America Blue initiative on October 2nd, 1 month before the event, and you'll probably be seeing and hearing a lot more about that. But its intent is not just to help the Kerry campaign, but to help all Democratic and progressive campaigns nationwide by tying them into one massive House Party program.
So. Right, because this is not just about Senator Kerry personally. This is about changing the face of America, changing the direction of America, and in order to do that, you need the American people behind it. And we have, I believe we have to come out in much more massive numbers than the Republicans because of all the stuff that they're going to pull from now to the election and even during the election. So it's going to be a real nasty fight for the next couple of months, but, you know, with hard work and perseverance, we will succeed, and we will hopefully succeed in not just putting Mr. Kerry into office, but putting an entire movement that's going to alter the direction of the entire country.
I'm with you, Joe. Let's do it.
Thank you, sir, for being on my show.
Thanks, Joe. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll be right back with more of the Cover Joe Radio Show.
Hi, kids. George Lowe, voice of TV's beloved Space Ghost. You are barking a happy tune with my close personal friend, the lovely Joe Vecchio, on the Cup O' Joe Radio Show.
This is Joe Vecchio reminding you that the Cup O' Joe Radio Show archives are available at the White Rose Society. That's www.whiterosesociety.org. And you can hear the show Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. and Sunday evenings at midnight Eastern Standard Time on rantradio.com. Help support Internet radio by donating generously to these fine sites. Back on the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. The URL for the site, once again, is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and the email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. I always encourage my listeners and the people who read my blogs to comment on the blog and to email me and just to talk about stuff. And I've got a couple of very special guests here in the studio with me. They were here to do a show about punk rock that I do on my audio show. And actually, I'm going to talk about that in another segment. But I want to talk to these guys because they're both fairly political in their thinking. And their name is Matt Murray. On the red mic is Matt Murray. And on the blue mic is C.B. Smith. And they are friends of mine who started a little film group called Cornpone Flicks, making a lot of really funny parodies. Very well made because they're very short. And they're about the only amateur filmmakers that I know of that aren't making tons of money that understand the art of pacing in a film. You see so many amateur filmmakers just drag shit out that shouldn't be. How you going, guys? How you doing?
Doing fine.
Okay.
Does my voice appear blue through this mic?
I guess so.
Fuckety, fuckety, fuckety.
Yeah,
out
there it is.
Yeah. You got your mic on, Matt?
Yeah, it's definitely on this time. I'm looking at the little switch. It says no because I've got it upside down. But
Now, we're not going to have any confrontational stuff here, really, because we're all kind of lefties in a way. Although, CB, you tend to be more of a... You don't really.
I have a puritanical upbringing.
You have a puritanical upbringing, and you have an autographed picture of Jesus too, if I'm not mistaken.
I do. It says "With love, Jay."
Jay.
I have an autographed book from Newt Gingrich signed to Leper Jim, which is my stage name. I don't think he knew what he was doing, but he did it anyway. And I almost wished that circumstance not for the country's sake, but that circumstances could have transpired to just bump him up two notches so that I could say the president of this country signed an autograph to Leper Jim and put it in one of our films. But I suppose it's probably best for everyone that didn't happen.
Well, Newt Gingrich had his time. And, what was funny was that he got kicked out because he wasn't tough enough in the long run, that he wasn't hardcore enough for him. And that's kind of scary. Did you guys watch any of the convention speeches or anything like that?
Well, since I worked at a TV station, I sort of had to sit through them.
You worked for the Evil Empire.
I worked
since I don't actually have television.
For the billionaire tyrant.
I listened to some of it on the radio.
Okay, and you work for Fox News, Matt, don't you?
Yes.
And now you don't work for the national. You work for one of the local stations.
No, just a local affiliate. And I don't write any of it. I just sort of, you know, I push some buttons and it goes out.
Well, you're a video editor and you set what goes out on. Okay, you set what actually goes out on the thing on the airwaves.
To some extent, so I put the tape in the machine. Somebody else rolls it. It's all very antiquated technology, yeah. But.
Well, it works, I guess. I mean, Fox News is a big deal right now, and the local they hit it big when they stole channel what the hell channel, because I'm a cable and I don't know what the actual channels are anymore, but they used to be on a VHF channel, CBS, and they had to move to channel 46 because Fox took them over. Now, yesterday was September 11th. Do you guys remember what you were doing 3 years ago? When you first heard about going on, you want to relate that information?
I was asleep. I slept through the whole thing because I work night shift. So I woke up and had no idea because I don't have TV either.
Well, how'd you find out?
I got an answering machine message from a friend of mine who lived in Texas, oddly enough, saying that everything was okay. And I'm not really sure why, because nothing happened in Texas, and I don't think there was ever any indication anything was going to happen in Texas.
Was that our friend Bruce?
No, it was Eileen.
Oh, okay.
Because she works at ExxonMobil. I think they were evacuated.
Oh, wonderful.
So... And she didn't really say anything beyond the cryptic, you better check the TV, which, of course, I couldn't do because I didn't have TV. So I was just sort of staring through the snow and hearing about something has happened. And then eventually my mother called and related the whole thing. And the buildings were already down by the point that I woke up. So,
CB, when did you first hear about it?
I work a late shift, not a night shift. Or at the time I was. So... I got up, and again, I don't have television, so I didn't watch that. As I was driving into work, I was listening to radio, and of course, that's all there was on the radio. So I heard about that, and I think I was not really cognizant the extent of what had gone on. And I got to work, and you know, I was thinking I would get to work, and I'd tell people, hey, have you heard about this? And in fact, that was exactly the opposite. I got to work, and everyone, of course, was doing nothing except looking at the television.
Right. It was a really, really weird day. I was actually at home working on a business plan, and I was just working on the internet, and I was going to take a break and say, well, let's see what's on in the news today. And it was taking forever to load up the New York Times website, and I'm thinking, what the hell is this? And I saw the picture, and I said, this has got to be a joke because it looks like a movie shot.
Yeah.
You know.
It didn't have the face of Satan in the smoke, though, so it wasn't Weekly World News.
Well, you know, I got a guy who wrote me, and being a left-wing talk show, I get people who write to me about really, really weird stuff. And there are people, and the rumors persist that there was no actual plane that hit the Pentagon. And I'm like, look, there was a plane that hit the Pentagon. It's quite – because the Pentagon is a much bigger building than it seems when they show it.
When they show you the whole Pentagon, you don't realize, you know, okay, that's really far up.
Really, really, really big building. And it's certainly conceivably possible that a plane could have buried itself so far in that it wouldn't be visible from the outside, especially if it came in as low – as they say it does. And the guy sent me something about how some conspiracy group was saying that it hadn't nearly hit, that they really blew it up with a bomb, and how come there's no other burn marks or anything near where the plane hit? Because, well, it really didn't crash before it hit the building.
I have heard the conspiracy theories about that, and, you know, I can't really explain it away, but I'm pretty sure that everyone who has mentioned this conspiracy theory to me has never actually investigated a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, amateur forensics are not exactly something I'm going to be going in for. And what does it even matter? The final result is the building got blowed up.
Even if the government did blow up the Pentagon themselves for whatever reason, they certainly didn't do anything on purpose to the World Trade Center.
What's the scuttlebutt where you guys work? Now, obviously, since you work at Fox News, I'm pretty sure they're mostly Bush supporters.
Sort of split. In fact, we've got one editor who is gay and cuts all of the anti-gay stories and all of the Bush stories. So I think that helps to balance that to some. Though he had a big George Bush, you're fired poster in his cubicle, and it got stolen.
Oh boy.
And was never returned, and that was sort of like, you know, well, look at the quality of supporters the other side has. This is why I'm not on your side.
Well, that's one of the things I noticed when I first got into politics, is that Republicans were just meaner. I mean, Democrats could be jackasses too, but the Republicans seem to revel in it. They rather enjoy it.
See, they set themselves up with that mascot, too. I mean, they're just asking for that comment.
Stevie, what about where you work? How is it going there as far as the scuttlebutt is concerned about Bush and the election?
Well, I try not to talk politics with my coworkers, but I would say to the extent that I suss their voting preferences, that I would say it's probably majority Bush. It's close, but I would say more of them, and I'm not even really sure. I think part of the problem is that people don't actually support the actual policies of the current administration. What they support is the current administration's vision of itself,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of people agree with a lot of the rhetoric and with the social ideals of the Republican Party. I mean, you know, a lot of the people at my job, if not homophobic, certainly don't understand these gay people and so forth. So they agree with that, and therefore they think that they agree with the Bush administration as a whole. But in fact, a lot of what the Bush administration is doing is against what these people think they are.
It's usually totally the opposite of what they're saying. I mean, if they're saying they're saving somebody, the odds are that they're killing somebody. You know, and I get into it with Bruce or Bichon, as I know him from the website, but B is an old friend, and when you have friends like that who take such a differing viewpoint and seem serious about it, sometimes it can put a serious strain on a friendship. And B is known to have lost a bunch of friends because of, you know, his attitudes about stuff. But when you're dealing with people on a day-to-day basis, and especially when, okay, let me try to phrase this correctly. You once gave me a book by James Randi. In fact, the first book by James Randi. James Randi was a stage musician who was one of the biggest skeptics in the world. He debunks mostly tarot card readers and stuff like that. But in the book that you gave me, he talked about type 1 faith, type 2 faith, or type A, type B, whatever. And the type A faith is basically where people are believing anything that they're told, and they absolutely will refuse to believe anything that contradicts it, no matter how obvious it is. And you would think that after 3 years of us trying to find these so-called weapons of mass destruction that supposedly justified this venture in Iraq, that, you know, they would finally realize maybe we were just being lied to. P.T. Barnum said there's a sucker born every minute. How often, and I guess maybe these are the people that Lincoln was talking about, you can fool some of the people all of the time. Do you ever think about that mindset, and you wonder if maybe you feel the same way on the left-hand side as they feel the way on the right-hand side? Do you think that lefties are really more cognizant of those sort of things? Or?
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think that, for example, I'm not even going to get up on a platform and say George Bush definitely lied. I will definitely say it really looks like they were wrong and they refused to admit it, which is not good either. I mean, in as much as, okay, their platform has continued to be, we went to war in Iraq and everything is better because of it, and they don't even really mention the weapons issue anymore.
They don't mention bin Laden.
They just don't bring it up. It's not even like, well, you know, for a while we're still looking, we'll find them eventually, it's a big country, et cetera, et cetera. And now they don't even bring the issue up at all, apparently in the hopes that people will forget about it.
Well, you would think that the idea that the casualties are still coming along even after we captured Hussein. And you would think that they made such a big deal about personalizing it, and yet, and it was obvious to everyone that just capturing Hussein was not going to be a big deal. And with bin Laden as well, even if to capture him now, it doesn't make a difference. It's too late. You think they're just adding more fuel to the fire with what's going on in Iraq, Stephen?
I don't know. I mean, there are certain ways in which I feel that, you know, something needed to happen in Iraq, that the situation there was not at all good for children and other living things, as the bumper sticker says. I am not in the least convinced that this was the exact right way to do it. I think the problem that I mainly have is not even necessarily with the personalization of the conflict. We are after this guy. We are after this guy. You know, the publicization of the deck of wanted cards and so forth. It's not even really that so much as it is just a lack of subtlety that, say what you will about George Bush's facility in speaking, which is not very high. Despite that, you know, he'd be fine if it weren't for the fact that I have never heard a subtle or nuanced position from him.
The only tool he has is a hammer.
Yeah, and I mean, to some extent, when you are the leader of a national party like that, you can't talk in subtleties because then it sounds like you're dissembling. But on the other hand, it just never feels like situations are plumbed in depth, that they decide to do something on the basis of a small series of very important ideas rather than thinking about what might be the consequences, whether capturing Hussein will stop anything.
And I think that, you know, that they tend to have this sort of dumbing down for the public view of what the war is about, because I don't know if a Democratic president would have done any differently, because all you ever hear on the news when they talk about this is that this is a war fighting for our freedom. Well, it's not about our freedom. The only war we ever fought for our freedom was the Revolutionary War. No one has ever tried to come in here and rewrite our Constitution and take our freedoms away. That is not what, you know, Osama bin Laden and his people do not sit around in a tent going, how should we minimize freedom in the world? That's like, you're not fighting Dr. Doom or Lex Luthor. You're fighting people who are mad because of political reasons. It's like, you know, if Osama bin Laden ruled the world, he would not have people locked in tiny boxes to minimize their freedom so they could be fed by robots and things like that. Mm-hmm. That is not what it's about. That's just this buzzword thing that we can throw out there because we have to graft the word freedom onto everything we say about America.
The best word is the word free.
Yeah. I mean, it's an advertising word.
Well, there does seem to be like a comic book attitude about this. We're, you know, only one of us is coming out of this country alive, and it won't be me. You know, that sort of thing.
And I have a problem basically with all political discourse at a national level. You know, that I do think that having read, you know, position papers and speeches of Kerry's, that he has, you know, some sophisticated ideas, but you would never understand that from, for example, listening to his speech at the Democratic National Convention, or in fact the speeches of anyone at any large convention, wherein all it is I say a sentence that you would have to be inhuman to disagree with, I get applause for 30 seconds, I say another sentence that only a moron would disagree with, and I get applause for 30, and so forth. It seems like there's very little actual content when they're trying to sell the party's policies. And, you know, the policies on both sides are more sophisticated than they are ever revealed to be in speeches, which is why I think debate is a necessary part of our political system. And, in fact, I wish it were a larger part.
Yeah, well, the debates that we're going to have, and I, for one, am wondering why we're even bothering to have it, considering how divided the country is, a really much more scripted thing. I mean, it's one candidate gets a chance to say his soundbite, and the other character says his soundbites. It's just remarkable to me, though, as we've gotten technology and communications technology, you know, the 24/7 news cycle and all that, that we would have more time for the kind of, let's take a look at the subtext, because obviously politics has always been about, you know, the quickest and best way to sell a candidate, like you're selling a product. Mm-hmm. I mean, this goes back, I mean, you can look at films like The Candidate, which was made in the 70s, and you can go back even further and look at how, you know, Eisenhower and how Truman and how FDR ran their campaigns. The country is still very conservative right now. I really don't see it changing. In fact, I'm fairly certain that Bush is going to get another 4 years. I refuse to say elected or reelected because I'm still am not convinced.
He'll get back in the building.
Yeah. So they
will find out that these hurricanes are all coming from some evil Republican hurricane making machine, so that he can go down there and show lots of support.
On the other hand, I could really support our troops if we were destroying an evil hurricane making machine.
There you go. Does it seem to be a little bit disingenuous? To say you support the troops, yet you throw them out in countries where they really don't have a right to be or have any idea of how they're going to get out of there. I mean, we're stuck in this quagmire now.
Well, I support the war. I just don't support the troops.
Okay.
That will confuse anyone you say it to. No.
Well, I can see the people. What the hell is he talking about? Yeah, that's it. Your show's off the
network. American soldiers are a bunch of bastards, but I love me some more. No, but
that does seem to be the Republicans' attitude.
I mean, the thing is that, you know, I do honestly think that conservatives who say that they support the troops and they want the best for the troops really mean it, even if they're not actually acting in the ways that are the best for the troops.
Like, for example, getting them bulletproof vests.
Yeah, or you know, to what extent they're, you know, cutting veterans' benefits and not allowing correct rotation on leave and so forth and so on. You know, obviously these are problems, but I think that really the basic question is exactly what needed to be done with the Army. That all of these other things are irritants, and if I were in the army, it would be a little more than irritating. It would be serious problems about how my country was treating me. But since I'm not in the army, I have the luxury of saying what was actually an issue is whether or not we should send the army, when we should send the army, and under what conditions. And that really is where the question lies, rather than in the niceties of what we're doing specifically for the troops now that they're there.
Well, what do you think? What do you guys think is going to happen in the near future, and in maybe the I don't want to say distant future, but say over the course of the next 50 years, where do you think the country's going?
Well, I'm not sure where the country's going, but I will say this: I think that unless something changes, sometime within the next 50 years, some terrorist group is going to get a nuclear device.
If they don't have one already.
They don't have one already. Nuclear devices are really, really complex technology. People don't understand. It's not like a normal bomb.
Right.
But, you know, I don't think they'll get the ability to manufacture nuclear weapons because that is so complex. You know, even a relatively large, semi-prosperous country like Iraq, which actually doesn't make all that money, but almost all of the country's money was being siphoned off by those at the top, you know, was not able to make a viable nuclear weapons program. So I think that, however, it's possible that a nuclear device might fall into the hands of a terrorist group within the next 50 years. And, I mean, obviously it's a terrible thing to contemplate, but I think that the fact that, if not inevitable, that is possible should make us think about what exactly we mean when we're talking about, you know, conducting a war on terror, when, in fact, that war is going to include casualties back at some point. You know, that a lot of people say that Bush is succeeding because there's not been an attack on U.S. soil. Well, there haven't really been all that many attacks on U.S. soil, period. So I'm not sure that the fact that there haven't been any since 2001 means much. But even so, if there is an attack on U.S. soil, I don't think that means that Bush immediately should be thrown out and shot because he failed completely, though his policies may contribute to such an attack. So I think that people are thinking about it all wrong, that, you know, terrorists are going to hit the U.S. That's going to happen in the future. So we have to be able to respond to that in a way that does not involve treating terrorist groups like they are rogue states, because they're not.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the question of, I mean, no one is going to say that these people are justified in any of this, but you have to look at it and say, okay, these people really hate us enough that they don't care if they die in the process of just killing a bunch of innocent people to make a point. Has America actually done something to make people legitimately angry? Not, you know, not that that justifies the what they've done in reprisal, but is there a better way the country might conduct itself that it doesn't give rise to this sort of hatred to begin with? You know, what are we doing that's pissing off the Middle East so much?
Well, that's certainly not all.
I don't think the situation in Iraq is helping that at all.
I think it's making much worse. In fact, Osama bin Laden predicted that in response to what happened at 9/11, that the Americans would bomb an oil-rich Arab country, which, of course, we did, and which is why terrorists are now flocking to al-Qaeda or forming their own little groups. We've got the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea pissed off at us now.
Well, if they can just, you know, attack each other, well, you know, over doctrinal issues, maybe we can...
I've always been worried about the oversimplification. And certainly the United States has done shit in the Middle East, not just recently, but, you know, going back to the 40s and the 50s. And, you know, the British tried to control what we now know as Iraq right after World War I. And this is actually not too dissimilar from what happened to them, because the first year that the Brits took over, and this was right after World War I, was fairly stable. You know, they had some stuff going on, but the really bloody part came the second year. And now we're in our second year in Iraq, and it just seems like things are getting worse and worse. 22 more people were killed in a bomb car explosion today, earlier today. Do you think Bush or Kerry is going to get in this election cycle?
Couldn't say. I think it's too close to call. I mean, I think what a lot of people don't remember for some reason from 2000 is that whether or not you feel Bush was fairly elected, that both he and Gore got about the same number of votes.
Yeah, it wasn't really very close. Yeah.
It was, you know, really close in terms of actual votes by actual people as opposed to votes by the electoral machine people. So I think that it's going to be similarly close. I don't know. I mean, my preference would be that Kerry would win. I'm not the world's biggest fan of his, but as I said, I think Bush's positions are sort of ludicrously simple at times.
Mm-hmm. And I think that this is just sort of looking at a long range, but the country, in as much as it is really conservative right now, tends to be almost like unconsciously adopting liberal values without really calling them that. I mean, people talk about they're against the liberal agenda or whatever, and they sort of, you know, they might be talking about the views that liberals are taking on the war in Iraq or whatever. But at the same time, I hear a lot of these same people, you know, are in favor of interracial marriage or gay marriage or decriminalizing drugs or things like this that have always been liberal issues. And even though these people are calling themselves conservative, they're sort of adopting bits of the liberal mindset, which the conservatives tend to, you know, when those issues, I mean, were hot button issues like, you know, desegregation, conservatism was against that. And most people nowadays, unless they're really backwoods, hate-mongering redneck types, do not come out and say, you know, no, keep those black people where they belong on their end of the city anymore. So I think we have made progress in that area. It's just, you know, a matter of if it's going to keep going in that direction.
The Republicans do seem to have a good knack for winning things in the short term, but losing things in the long term. I mean, a lot of the things that we take for granted now that we're violently opposed. And there are people who talk about how, you know, there's going to be an upcoming liberal majority. And actually, we do have a liberal majority in this country. We're just not as organized and as well-funded as the right-wing machine that's really going out there. I just don't know.
I won't work with you because you're not a vegetarian.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you're not liberal enough for me, so.
Yeah, there is that attitude. In the music show, I played a clip from Jello Biafra talking about how cliquish some people can be, and you know, if you're a meat eater, then you're evil, you know, in any way, in all ways. And I'm like, you know, you can't really be that way all the time. You have to understand that there's, you know, it's 280 million people in this country, and everybody's a little bit different. But the Republicans do seem to march in lockstep more often than we do. We lefties tend to fight amongst each other.
Well, I think that. I'm not going to attribute that to a greater sense of nuance and intelligence on the part of the left, because I've met plenty of really stupid liberals.
Yeah, sure.
I am one.
But
I will say that I think what it is that the right tends to focus on one issue. And I think part of the division in the current election cycle is because the left has become focused on a single issue, the war in Iraq, with the economy merely a backup punch once they're reeling from that first one. You know, that there are plenty of things that people are concerned about, but just the focus on performance by the Bush administration is a lot more single-minded, I think, this time around. I think that's what contributes to the stridency of the arguing. But I think the right has always had that capacity to say, you know, look, you know, liberals are for these black people taking your jobs. You know, a really simple, really single argument that a bunch of people can latch onto or whatever.
Right.
And again, I don't want to say that the right has always been on the wrong side of history, because that's simply not true. But
they do seem to be, when they get a lot of power, they do tend to abuse it. It seems.
Well, I think that's true of basically. If I had a lot of power, I would abuse it.
Well,
you know how many Natalie Portman clones there would be if I had power.
I'm not a Natalie Portman
fan. At least
fan,
two.
So.
Well, good, because that's one less person I have to kill.
Well, I look at. It's not so much getting power, because the Democrats have been ruthless before. They're not as ruthless now as they used to be. I mean, JFK was very, very tough candidate. So was Lyndon Johnson.
Heck, he got into that gunfight with his driver, ended up getting killed.
That's right. So, but if you look at what has been done with the power once they got it, I mean, certainly since 1932, when the New Deal took over, the Democrats ran things a lot differently than the Republicans are running now. And during the war, Roosevelt had prominent Republicans come on his cabinet to help out with the war effort, because he believed that that was a more, you know, important thing than political partisanship. But it just seems to me that the Republicans have taken it to another level. I mean, if you're not with us, you're against us. If you don't agree with us 100%, then we don't even want you in our little clique. And it was something, again, that Jello Biafra talked about with the click thing, and here we have it at the highest level of politics. So,
People are pretty much the same at every level. I mean, you have two people that don't like each other, and you call it a fight. You got two people who run countries who don't like each other, and you call it a war. It's the same issue.
It's the same
issue. We don't like what you're doing, so...
Yeah.
I think the major failing I see with that the right does not understand or does not choose to promulgate, and that the left doesn't explain clearly enough, is that government is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
That you hear so much about people who say, I'm sick of big government, I don't want government in my life. It's like, look, government is there for people. That's the whole reason government exists, is to smooth out the interactions between people and to provide things that you may not be able to provide on your own.
Or private companies.
Yeah, and it seems like people just don't understand how important, you know, a government, no matter what particular form you happen to endorse, is that, you know, I want the government interfering in my life because that means I don't have to do everything perfectly. If I make a mistake, there is a government there to either stop me from making it or to help me once I have.
Mm-hmm.
And just I think that the left is insufficiently explained that, look, yes, yeah, the government does involve taking money from people and giving it to other people. I want that. I don't trust people to give money to other people. People are jerks. You know, I'm a jerk. I don't give to charity on a regular basis. You know, I feel like I should, however, so I'm glad there's a government taking my money and doing it for me.
Mm, okay. And some people will say, well, you know, you've just lost every sense of individualism and, you know, but
yeah,
I've never.
Exactly.
I've never agreed with.
I still feel that I'm an individual, but I feel that collective bargaining is very powerful.
Well,
I mean, that's what the market is based on. I think that's what government should be based on, too.
When I argue with libertarians, I say, oh, yeah, you built the road you drive on. You supply your own water and electricity, and you do all of that stuff by yourself. Nobody ever does it. There seems to be just an attitude that not only can't a group do anything, but a group shouldn't do anything. So, I don't know. We're going to close this out. We're just about at 30 minutes here. So, guys, I want to thank you for being on the show.
Oh, well, thank you.
Just a nice little conversation. CB, you guys, well, both of you, CB and Matt, you haven't done much for Cornpone Flicks lately. Cornpone Flicks is their little film group.
We haven't done anything new, but Matt has been working on reworking some old stuff.
Okay, well that's cool.
I've had, you know, faulty equipment for years, and I just, within the last couple of months, got a computer that does not try to burst into flame when you turn it on. So
you had a Mac.
Yeah.
you can check out the website, which is cornponeflix.org. We really didn't talk about the filmmaking stuff, but that really wasn't.
Well, nobody out there really cares, really, or nobody,
yeah.
you know.
But you can check out cornponeflix.org. You'll even find a little piece with me in there somewhere.
And there's a link to your website on there.
I noticed that when I was checking out, because I always check out how many hits I'm getting a day and where they're coming from, and I was surprised to see that. And when I checked that, I said, oh, yeah, they added the link. So that was nice of them. Well, guys, you take care, and maybe we'll do this again sometime in the not-too-distant future. Maybe I'll have you on. We'll do a live election coverage, and we'll just yell and scream at the TV.
I'm sure I'll be at work that day. No, that'll be a glorious day.
Party.
All right.
We'll
take care. I want to thank my guests for the show, Matt Murray and C.B. Smith of Cornpone Flicks, who we just talked to, and David Saley, who is, he doesn't have an official title, but he directs the House Party fundraisers for the Kerry campaign, and we hope that Senator Kerry raises as much money as he can to fight the mighty right-wing machine. At any rate, this is Joe Vecchio from the Cup of Joe Radio Show, signing off for yet another show. Be sure to click on the website, cupojoe.blogspot.com. I haven't updated it in a little while yet because, well, I've been busy with other shit and stuff happens. And, of course, my email is joevec@bellsouth.net. You can check out cornponeflicks.org. That's C-R-O-N-P-O-N-E, flicks, F-L-I-C-K-S.org. And that will give you a filmography of the different amateur films that are going on. So until next time, this is Joe Vecchio from the Cup of Joe Radio Show, signing off. Bye. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe Radio Show, is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been a production of Jove Enterprises, Incorporated.